Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Kate Young.
I think I'm pretty entrepreneurial minded. Like, my friends and family joke that I'm always coming up with different schemes and ideas of like businesses that we could run, and a lot of them have been more ridiculous.
Today on our show, we talk with the owners of Friendly Beasts, a new cidery in Bloomington, Indiana. And Doug Spradley, head bartender at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, introduces us to a warming and festive cocktail for those chilly winter evenings. Harvest Public Media brings us a story on fraud in the organic food industry. That's all coming up on Earth Eats. Mark Chilla has the week off, but he'll be back next week with a wrap-up of the year's food news from Chad Bouchard. In 2016, the U.S. organic food industry brought in a whopping $43 billion. That's thanks in large part to shoppers who will pay extra for apples or corn grown without genetic modifications or synthetic pesticides. But Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports some people are trying to take advantage of the premium prices by passing off conventional food as organic. And that could undermine the whole industry.
Did you know NFL star Peyton Manning is an official organic certifying agent? Apparently, the now-retired quarterback signed off on a shipment of grain, verifying it was indeed organic, for a certification agency called OneCert. That surprised OneCert's president, Sam Welsh, who definitely does not remember hiring Peyton Manning.
So, you know, I'm sure they found his signature somewhere on the internet and put it on one of our certificates.
Welsh's company, based in Nebraska, is accredited by the U.S. Department of Agriculture to inspect everything from small vegetable farms to processing plants and international grain operations. He says people all along the food production chain try to scam the system by making counterfeit certificates.
There's an incentive for people who want to get organic prices for products that are not organic, because organic products generally are worth more than the conventional.
The scope of the problem isn't well documented, but the USDA recently published a list of 90 fraudulent certificates forged since 2008. Violators can face fines starting at $11,000, up to jail time if criminal charges are brought forth by the USDA. The USDA declined an interview for this story. Gwendolyn Wired is with the Organic Trade Association, which tracks the growth of the industry. She says even penalties don't always deter lawbreakers.
We can expect that there's going to be more attempts at fraud. And while we've been very proud of our system, we have to do a much better job.
She says the longer and more complex the supply chain is, the more potential risk it has for fraud. Think about corn tortilla chips. Maybe the corn came from a farm in Ukraine, then was stored in a grain elevator, traveled by truck, ship, and rail to a mill, then a processing and packaging plant, all to finally end up in a bag on a store shelf. Each spot where the corn changes hands is vulnerable for fraud and is a place to lose what the booming organic industry relies on, trust from organic shoppers, like Olivia Meyer in Columbia, Missouri. Today, Meyer is in the snack aisle of the local health food store picking out tortilla chips.
For my family, I really love just a very simple tortilla chip. We look for the fewer ingredients in the bag, the better, and definitely something organic.
That USDA organic label means something to her, like fewer chemicals and perceived health benefits.
If I were to find out that these organic blue corn chips were not actually organic blue corn chips, I would feel tricked and like I was wasting my money, and sort of like, why spend the premium if that wasn't the case?
Would you want your money back?
Yeah, I would definitely want my money back.
The Organic Trade Association knows it can't lose shoppers like Meyer and is trying to target one of the most exposed parts of the organic supply chain, shipment ports. Wired says the association is pushing legislation to make sure the middlemen in organic sales, who might not even touch the products, follow organic rules too. Right now, they're not, which means they could get away with flipping a conventional crop as an organic one.
That means that he or she is not getting their required annual inspections. You don't actually have an inspector that's going in and looking at all of the paperwork and all that activity every year, as is required with a certified operation.
The Organic Farmer and Consumer Protection Act that's awaiting a committee hearing in the U.S. House closes that loophole. The bill also requests more money for enforcing organic standards and investing in technology to improve tracking in the international market.
This is a label that is all about trust, and if you want to take trust out of the supply chain very quickly, fraud is a way to do it.
Wired is optimistic about the bill, but the trade organization also is pushing for these requests to be included in the next farm bill, with those congressional talks likely getting underway in early 2018. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
That story comes from our partners at Harvest Public Media. You can find more at harvestpublicmedia.org. My daily commute includes a walk or a bike ride down the Beeline Trail in Bloomington. This fall, a new cidery popped up directly facing the trail near 2nd Street. Friendly Beasts is the name. I noticed some outdoor seating with a garage door thrown open for a view into a cozy bar space open a few evenings a week. To be clear, we're talking hard cider here, alcoholic beverages made from apples. I stopped in one Saturday to sample the cider and talk with the owners.
We've got five of them today. We've got our sweetest one called Sweet Snout, and that's kind of like a dessert cider, so very apple forward and sweet on the finish. And then we have our seasonal hit, Cinna Sloth, and so that's a cinnamon cider, slightly toasty and sweet. And then the Buzz Boomer is a hopped cider with honey, and it's made with an Australian yeast. And boomer is another word for a male kangaroo. So we got the buzz from the honey and the boom from the kangaroo part. And then the Whale's Bow Tie is a semi-dry cider, very clean, crisp, tart. And Cortad is our newest cider, and it's special because it's aged on cocoa nibs and in oak staves, and then finished with a bit of vanilla.
What is a stave?
It's a wood chip, just a fancy word for it. So not barrel aged, but still has some oak contact.
I will try the Cortad.
Sure. Do you want a 12-ounce pour, or a 5-ounce pour, or a splash?
Five. I think the oak makes sense. Like, I can kind of, I don't have the best palate for this kind of thing, but I do think that I'm tasting something almost tanniny, which I like.
The wood adds a lot of tannin.
I came back to Friendly Beasts for an after-hours conversation with the owners Fatima Carson and Ben Romline. It's part of a new series here on Earth Eats called Making the Leap. The series is focused on what it takes to get started with a new food business, or in this case, a new beverage business. I'm interested in what inspires someone to muster up the courage to make the leap into the unknown, into the unpredictable world of running a small business.
We're just really into apples, and apples are just such a cool fruit. All the different variations in the apples, and all the different types of apples there are, and the different tastes and flavors in them. So that really fascinated us. And for a while we thought that we wanted an orchard, and we were reading orcharding books and looking at like orchard property, but that seemed like a lot of work to maintain a whole orchard when we hadn't ever really done anything like that before. So we're like, well, maybe we can do something else with the apples. And then the cider thing came up, and we thought that seemed really cool because it used a lot of the same things we liked about the apples and the variations of apples and all the different factors that go into that sort of scratch that itch. So we started making the cider at home and had a lot of fun doing that.
We'd read about so many different kinds that you could make, but just when you go out to go shopping in town, most of the ciders are really sweet. And so we thought, why not try making our own one to drink? And so we went to Blooming Foods and bought a gallon of the apple juice that they sell there, and went to Butler and bought a packet of yeast and made a 1-gallon batch. And then we waited 3 months to drink that one, and it turned out really well. So then we went and bought a whole bunch more 1-gallon jugs, and then we'd wait, and it would be like a grand experiment to see how it turned out a few months later. We must have made maybe 7 gallons at first, and then that fall we probably made 50, and then the next year closer to 200. And then at that point we started thinking about opening it as a business, so then that was this fall. think I'm pretty entrepreneurial minded. Like my friends and family joke that I'm always coming up with different schemes and ideas of like businesses that we could run, and a lot of them have been more ridiculous, but people humor me with those pitches. And then once we got into this, both of our families live in Michigan, and there's so many more small cideries up there. And so then we were kind of like, we might be able to do this in Bloomington.
Next, I wanted to know, what goes into making hard cider? What kind of equipment do you need? What's the process? We started in the back room where the cider is made. Bromline walks us through a description of the cider press.
You can see up here the chute is where you can just chuck whole apples down, and then it's got a thing that spins around and crushes them up and mashes them, and they come out through this little red pouch dealy into a tray down here. And then what you do is you set up pieces of cloth, basically cheesecloth, that catches all the mash that falls out, and then you fold those up into little pouches, basically, and you stack them one on top of the other in between little plastic plates or trays. And then we stack them about six high and then just slide them right down the tray here. And that big arm with the plate on it is the pressing hydraulic press. And that lever right there with the little red rubberized thingy on the end of it, you just push that down, and then it presses all the juice out of the mash. And then it falls out of a little chute down at the end of the tray. And then we pump it right into the tanks. We ferment everything, and it takes about 2 weeks to, you know, ferment it for the yeast to do the process and it to get alcoholic. And then we like to age it for as long as we can. A lot of cideries have a filter that they can use to clarify the product to make it so it's clear in the glass and not cloudy, because right after you've fermented, it's still cloudy. So as it ages, all that stuff that makes it cloudy settles out onto the bottom. Then you can get rid of it, essentially, and get the clear product out.
So you're having to look ahead quite a bit to plan.
Yeah, but once it's fermented, it's sort of stable, so we can just take 50 gallons out of the big one and put that into all the keg.
Do just, like, we've done some general estimating, because you have to figure out, since apples are only available in the fall, like the orchard we work with, we had to estimate for him, like, how many apples we were going to want. And then we're getting some juice pressed and frozen for us, so we'll be able to keep producing fresh cider throughout the tail end of the winter and spring and summer before apples come online again.
Yeah, that's the real stressful part there, because you don't want to undershoot that and then run out of supply to make it later on in, you know, the early spring or whatever.
So we had to have kind of like a reserve before open this fall, so we had to make a fairly large amount. And so it would have time to clear. And now we're kind of in the ideal time, since there's apples still available. We're going to get some more in a couple weeks and then kind of refill up part of the supply and have it rotating. So you'll have different tanks at different stages in the process, like one that's aged and clarified and ready to go, and then newer ones. And then there's like differences that we'll do within each of the kinds of containers we're using. So we'll do different apple blends, and those change the cider a lot, or use kind of a similar blend of apples but with different yeasts. So there's a lot of variables to play with, and I think that's part of why we like it and what makes it so much fun, is that you can just make up a new batch kind of whenever you want to try something and find out if you like it and if people like it.
So what are all the variables that will give you a different tasting cider?
There's so many. Like Fatima said, the apples, I mean, year to year, the same apple from the same tree is going to produce a different flavor depending on how much rain it got, how much sun it got. So, I mean, growing conditions are variable. The apples themselves are variable. The yeast that we use, the conditions that we pitch the yeast in, if it's hot when we pitch it, if it's cold when we pitch it. And then certainly after we've got fermented cider that's aged and clarified, then, you know, it's the whole plethora of ingredients of the world of spices and sweeteners and, you know, anything you can imagine gets to be a factor that could be a flavor in the cider.
Where do you get the yeast?
Butler Winery, their brew store, has a whole bunch of different varieties that we've tried out. We've been ordering online from different brewer supply stores. We've gotten really into this one from the Australian Wine Research Institute. It's supposed to be really good for making ciders with non-cider varietal apples. And that one seems to have worked really well for us.
And then just one of the days when we were open for business, Matt Bachman stopped in and he was telling us some about his yeast projects that he's working on. So we hope in the future to try out some of those and see what's already kind of on the apples and some of the yeast that he might be able to propagate with us. So it seems like there's a lot of potential and the yeast part's very interesting.
We interviewed biochemist Matt Bachman last week on our show. He has a yeast lab and a company called Wild Pitch Yeast. If you missed it, you can listen anytime at eartheats.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
And all the apples, once you press them in the juice itself, it has just millions and millions of particles of yeast already in there. So we've done a few where it's just a wild ferment and we just let the yeast do its thing. But those we're too nervous with, so we only do small 5-gallon batches for now. But so for the rest of the cider, we treat it with a low dose of sulfites before we pitch our own yeast in. But we're excited to experiment with like having the natural yeast in there and then adding a yeast and doing some more experiments that way. It's kind of high risk, high reward. If it turns out well, it's going to be delicious in our experience. But if it's gross, it's going to be not salvageable. So we try to keep those small scale batches for right now.
So you're talking about just a wild yeast ferment where you did not add any yeast. You just let the apples do their thing.
Mm-hmm. So we put two of those on tap so far since we've been open. And people seem to really like those ones. So I think every time we press apples, we'll do 1 or 2 5-gallon batches just to see what the yeast variety that was on those apples makes.
That sounds really fun and interesting. And I get that it's a risk, but it also sounds like a risk that might be worth it.
Yeah, we really like that. It's a lot of fun to see how it turns out.
Yeah, it's nice to have a product that's so natural, like no sulfites, no sweetener, nothing added to it. So those ones are really satisfying when they turn out well.
Playing with yeast and making cider sounds like a lot of fun. When we return to our conversation with Fatima Carson and Ben Romline, we hear about some of the challenges and surprises they faced in starting their own cidery. Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers. On Bloomington's east side, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. Brunch every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. NeedMoreRoasters.com. We're back with Fatima Carson and Ben Romline of Friendly Beasts Cidery in Bloomington, Indiana. Since starting a business is so much about leaping into the unknown, I had to ask about some of the challenges and surprises they'd encountered. Cideries fall into the category of winery, so that was the type of permit they needed. But that wasn't really the tricky part.
There was some confusion with the state of Indiana. There was like a new person that had started that hadn't done winery permits. But then it turned out we needed a bunch of local approvals first. And in order to get those, you have to get all the different departments in Bloomington to agree or give you approval before you can then get your state permit. So we had to get Monroe County Building, Fire, Water, the Utilities Department, and County Health. So we contacted Health first, and they said you needed to talk to Water because there's special rules about what you can put down the drain when you're a business in Bloomington, and you have to meet the water requirements before you can start satisfying any of the other hoops. I think there's some challenges, like when you're used to dealing with some like a place like Upland or any of the big breweries, that then when you're talking about such a small batch size, how to treat that is pretty different, or like in some ways pretty similar, but in other ways really different. But once we talked to the right people, everyone was helpful and we were able to get the ball rolling.
I asked what was most surprising, and they both agreed their biggest surprise came on opening weekend.
How did it go your first weekend that you opened?
It was crazy. it was just crazy seeing everyone come in to the space that we'd made and drink the cider that we'd made and, you know, pay money to do it. Like, I know, I mean, I don't know. That always just kind of blows my mind every time people are here. It's just like, oh, wow, they really like this stuff. So that felt really good. But it was a really big crowd, and we got a lot of really positive feedback. And we ended up selling out of cider entirely that weekend. We wanted to be open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. But we sold out of cider on Saturday night. They drank everything that we'd made up. So that next week, we ordered twice as many kegs. And that seems to have worked a lot better for us ever since then.
The aspects of it are surprising. There's like the surprising challenges of like finding the space and building that out. There are parts of that that were harder than I expected. But I guess the surprise, like what it felt like Ben was describing earlier, to have people come into this, people you don't know and who have no other connection to you, come into a space that you've put a lot of time and energy into building, and then drink a product that you made, and then seeing their reaction. Because prior to opening, we'd only ever given the cider to our friends and family, and you can only trust their opinions for so much. Definitely got kind of an eclectic vibe in how we've designed it with the lounge and the tables and chairs. And one of my favorite quotes is when people come in, there've been a couple different groups that are like, this is just so Bloomington. And I don't know like how that's a vibe that we managed to capture, but we love Bloomington. So I took that as very positive. Yeah, so people, we just wanted to create a space where people could come and enjoy each other's company and have a good time. We both still have like our other day jobs that we're doing in the meantime, so we were able to start on like a pretty small scale that we can kind of just grow as the demand for the product grows, so we don't need it to be our entire livelihood right away, that we can just kind of do it as a hobby gone wild and share that with people, and then as it becomes profitable, think about investing kind of in other equipment, or if it would make sense to try to distribute some to other bars and restaurants in town. It's just kind of one step at a time, but I'd love to see it grow and share the product with more people. We've had several customers ask us if we're a seasonal business, and then one person asked if we were just a pop-up shop for the weekend. And so that was kind of ideas I hadn't thought of, but also made me a little bit nervous that people might not think of cider as a year-round drink.
To address that seasonal concern, they've added a hot mulled cider to the menu for the colder months. It's seasoned with warming spices like ginger, cardamom, star anise, and cinnamon. Carson reflected on the lifestyle changes since they opened their new cidery.
Having the business kind of changes our own like socializing or weekly routine, that in the past when you might have activities or events planned for the weekend, now like our weekends are kind of planned out, at least for the time being. So it's nice to have folks stop in and say hey when we're here. Yeah, I joked at one point that we used to go out to the bar, but we are now a bar. So that was pretty fun. Just those realizations as you're having them, that's surprising, I think.
That was Fatima Carson and Benjamin Romline of Friendly Beast Cidery in Bloomington, Indiana. You can find photos of the cidery, including that fancy cider press they talked about, at eartheats.org. This time of year, you might be doing a bit of entertaining at home, having a few friends over, or maybe you just want to make a festive winter drink for a change of pace. We're back at Farm Bloomington Restaurant this week, but instead of the kitchen, we're headed to the bar. Doug Spradley is the lead bartender at Farm, and he's got an extra special cocktail recipe to share with us, perfect for winter nights.
I'm Doug Spradley. I'm the head bartender here at Farm Bloomington, and today we're going to make a little kind of fun dessert cocktail that we do here. It's actually called our Bloomington Coffee. So the base of this drink was actually my kind of thought process of making a down-home kind of nice, like, creamy coffee drink based actually on what's called a Spanish coffee. That's actually famous in Portland, Oregon. So I wanted to actually bring something big town to our little small city. So first I'm going to start with is actually our latte mug. And I'm going to rim this with a lemon wheel. And then I'm going to dip this in sugar.
So he ran the wedge of lemon around the edge of the glass.
Now for actually why we call it the Bloomington Coffee, we use the Cardinal Songbird Coffee Liqueur. This is actually our base spirit. We want to have something that's a little bit sweet, but kind of tasty. So I'm doing 1.5 ounces of this into our latte mug. And then we're using Eldorado's 151 rum. So I'm using 1/2 ounce of this, using a bar spoon. Press against the side of the glass. I'm going to pour this slowly over the back of the spoon, which will then actually allow it to float on top of that coffee liqueur. And now the slightly more fun that you can't see on the radio part, I'm going to light up this bamboo skewer. I'm going to light that rum up.
Spradley lights the rum with the flame of the bamboo skewer.
Now we're caramelizing actually the sugars inside the glass from the rim, and we're actually cooking off that alcohol from the rum. So we're going to let that kind of cook here for a moment.
So it's a blue flame dancing inside that glass.
All right, now here's the tricky part, trying not to burn yourself, but usually I don't recommend any people doing this unless they blow that flame out. I've always kind of done it with a little more fun and pizzazz, just a little craziness. So I'm adding the coffee kind of to the side of the glass.
If you pour the coffee carefully along the side of the glass, you can keep the flame going for a while longer. It's a beautiful thing to see.
There we go. Now the rum kind of is going out. This is actually our house whipped cream. I make it usually every about 2 days. So just heavy cream and simple syrup, charged. Then that same lemon, I'm just gonna use that as a garnish. And there you are, that is one Bloomington coffee.
This drink will warm you up and possibly wake you up on a cold winter's night. You can see photos of Spradley and his visually appealing cocktail on our website. We have the recipe posted there as well, eartheats.org. Support comes from Needmore Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers on Bloomington's east side corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. Brunch every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. NeedmoreRoasters.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And a big thank you to the Earth Eats crew, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, Farm Bloomington Restaurant, Indiana University Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Our executive producer is John Bailey. This is Kate Young, and that's our show. We'll see you next week.